Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
After debating this issue exhaustively for a year, let's move forward together.
Passing a health care bill is a lot like rolling a snowball up a hill. The further you push it, the bigger it gets. It would be really nice for Barack Obama if he had some help. Because the bigger it gets, the heavier it gets. As soon as you get near the top, it rolls back down.
Americans are demanding that President Obama and the Democrats in control of Congress scrap their misguided plan of a government takeover of health care.
She took a tiny bit and rolled it up again. She had to let it go. I saw it go straight down.
The White House is trying for one more push up the hill on health care. Is this the time they reach the top? Or is it just another snowball?
And it rolled back down. And it rolled back down.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for just a couple of more days, and I'm here with Celeste on healthcare. The takeaway for me is, you know, this new proposal the president has come up with is not too much different from the old proposals. It's going to be interesting to see how this one gets passed, if it can.
Well, yeah, and whether it's truly a reset or it's just a reset of public opinion. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Another blow to the Taliban's senior leadership this morning. Our partner, The New York Times, is reporting Pakistani authorities have captured Mullah Kabir, a member of the group's inner circle and the leading military commander in eastern Afghanistan. The arrest appears to be a strictly Pakistani operation. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that's a good sign.
The recent events have been another positive indication of the Pakistanis' commitment to stabilizing this border area.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon now says 21, not 27, Afghan civilians were killed by a NATO airstrike on Sunday. On Capitol Hill, a jobs bill is expected to pass the Senate tomorrow after five Republicans broke ranks to join Democrats in shutting down a filibuster. Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown was among them.
Staying on Capitol Hill now, President Obama is trying to resurrect health care reform, but Republicans say the new plan looks too much like the old one. So what is new in the president's latest health care proposal? We're joined now by Mary Agnes Carey. She's senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Good morning, Mary Agnes.
Good morning.
Mary Agnes, the president says he's hitting the reset button, resetting the debate on health care. Does this proposal do that? Is it the reset button?
Well, it certainly might be trying to fast forward, trying to get new momentum into this bill, into discussions over the bill to try to get it over the finish line. The bill mirrors a lot of the provisions in the Senate package. It makes some changes in this Cadillac tax on the high-cost plans. It raises the threshold, but says it doesn't start for all the plans until about 2018, and that includes all health care plans. There's no carve-out specifically for the union plans that have been there before.
Okay.
He would give the federal government some new authority to regulate health insurance plans with an advisory board. He does a lot of things that are very similar in the bills. Medicaid expansion, cover more folks under Medicaid, more subsidies to help people purchase coverage.
Okay, and with all of these details, Mary Agnes, we're going to see if it is a reset for Republicans or even gets all of the Democrats on board. That's going to be incredibly important. Stay with us, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney is in a Washington, D.C. hospital this morning after experiencing chest pains last night. His assistant says the 69-year-old is resting comfortably. Doctors are evaluating the situation.
And now to the markets. Asian markets were mixed. Yesterday, European indices are up. Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,242. Coming up, we talk about work life every Tuesday. And with so many people looking for a job out there, interview questions, frankly, are getting a little weird. We tell you how to navigate them and tell you the real answer to a question like this. If you were a cereal, what cereal would you be? That sometimes comes up.
In our series, Frustration Nation continues. News today, frustration with Washington, not a new thing. Tell us, what was the single most irritating moment you faced in politics, now or then? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to the website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here filling in for John Hockenberry for a couple of more days, and Celeste is here with me. President Obama unveiled his health care proposal yesterday. It's about 11 pages long, and if you were looking for a drastically different health care bill than the one that's faltered so far in Congress, this isn't it. The president has apparently ignored calls from Republicans to scrap his bill completely and start over with a blank sheet of paper. But nevertheless, he is trying to reset the debate. So to find out exactly what's in the proposal and what the president is trying to do, we're joined by Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, is back with us as well. Trudy, I want to start with you. What are the major parts of this proposal? What's in it that we haven't seen before already knocking around Congress?
Well, we have seen penalties for people who don't buy insurance, and they've been reduced somewhat in this bill, which of course raises the question whether people will take these lower penalties now, $325 for the first year the law is in effect, and or will they buy insurance at some price, and we don't know what the price is. The other thing that is new, which Mary Agnes alluded to a little bit ago, is this insurance oversight on the federal level. This plan by the president would set up this federal authority, which would take a look at some of these rate increases that insurance companies have been proposing and decide whether or not they are exorbitant and whether or not they should be reduced. It's not clear exactly how this is going to fit in with some of the state regulation, but there would be this other layer of oversight, and hopefully or perhaps jawbone the insurance companies into reducing the rates if there was no strong regulatory authority in the law. The excise tax has been tweaked a little bit.
Now, you're talking about high-cost plans,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're talking about the Cadillac, so-called Cadillac plans, the benefit, the plans that have richer benefits. These would now, the tax would now fall on union plans as well as non-union plans and go into effect sometime after 2018. This is a little bit different than what was in the first bill, which was, basically it was an agreement not to tax the union negotiated plans for some period of time. So there's a little bit more equity here. Those plans are still somewhat problematic from the consumer standpoint, because if benefits are eventually reduced, as many experts think they will be, what does this do in terms of letting people go underinsured, which has been a big problem and has certainly been talked about a lot during this debate? So we really don't know what effect that will have either on saving money in the long run or in what people will have in coverage. We just know that it will happen and eventually affect about one quarter of the plan.
Well, let me ask Mary Agnes Carey of Kaiser Health News about this. Mary Agnes, what Trudy Lieberman is describing is a lot of tweaks apart from this new sort of federal crackdown on insurance companies raising their rates. Why, after the health care bill essentially stalling, if not failing, in Congress, would the president more or less retread proposals that the public seems to have said they don't like? Or is that what he's doing?
Well, the president has made, and his advisors have made a political calculation that their best interest is to push for the biggest bill now, and that voters will punish them not only at the midterm elections but in subsequent elections if Democrats don't deliver on the big package. It's a risk. It's a gamble, but he's made this a top priority. He ran for it for the presidency, ran on this issue. A lot of members of Congress were elected on this issue, and he feels that he's, I think, going to use his political capital and push Democrats who might be reluctant to now embrace this to do so, and it's a decision that they've made.
So that this new proposal seems to be about getting Democrats in lockstep, not so much winning over Republicans, I guess. And I want to ask you about some numbers that are out there, Mary Agnes, because there's something that's really interesting. And some of the interesting polling numbers come from the Kaiser Family Foundation, where you work. Just by way of example, closing the Medicare prescription donut hole, a gap in Medicare coverage, that's in the bill. And according to polling, 68% of the public wants that. Ending discrimination against Americans with pre-existing conditions. According to the Washington Post ABC poll, 80% of Americans want that. Incredibly popular. And yet the bill that the president is proposing is essentially unpopular. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's viewed, a lot of the Republican talking points have gotten through to people. For example, you mentioned some of this Kaiser Family Foundation polling. There's actually a new health tracking poll out today, for example, right? To your point,
When asked, do you support health care reform, it split 43% for, 43% opposed, and the rest of the folks undecided. I think there's a lot of messages Republicans have put out about the bill. It's going to be a government takeover. It's going to raise your health care costs. It's going to decimate the Medicare program. A lot of those messages have prevailed, but when they get into asking people about specific provisions, just as you noted, many polls show that people accept these provisions and want them and support them. So that's going to be the war for the White House and for Democrats that want to vote for this bill. How do you get that message to the public, and how do you get the public support behind this bill?
And Trudy, that would be my question to you. If Mary, if we are correct in saying that the provisions themselves are popular, but health care reform is not, the bill itself is not, how can you then reset when you're not truly resetting?
Well, the problem has been, and we've observed this on CJR.org basically for the last 2 years, that what's in these bills, what the goal was, has not been effectively communicated to people by the White House or most other politicians as well. We've dealt a lot in slogans, affordable quality health care on the Democratic side, government-run health care on the Republican side. You can keep what you have if you have insurance from the White House. So I think what is in the bill, what it's been trying to do, has not been communicated effectively. And I went out and did my own little man-on-the-street interviews in New York on Saturday and found, indeed, the people I sampled in my very small scientific sample, that they are split and they do not understand what's in the bill. And if they have insurance, they say, well, it's not going to affect me. So I think the goals of reform, which have changed in the White House's mind, have not been effectively communicated. We first started out with universal coverage and now are ending up with insurance reform and deficit reduction. And so you can see this progression of shift in what health reform was supposed to do. Well, I would argue that the people have seen through that.
Well, Trudy, the White House has a challenge. As you say in your straw poll, people are split. Nationally, they seem to be split. And if the president is resetting, we'll see if he can reset with the public and with his own Democrats. Trudy Lieberman is contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and a healthcare specialist. Mary Agnes Carey, of course, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some top stories we're following.
Federal prosecutors have launched a criminal investigation into Toyota's safety problems. Today and tomorrow, company executives are expected to testify in Capitol Hill. In an opinion piece published in the Wall Street Journal today, Toyota's president has acknowledged that his company stumbled badly. Top military leaders are also testifying this week on the Hill. They're focusing on whether gays and lesbians should be able to serve openly in the military. Yesterday, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General Raymond Odierno, said sexual orientation shouldn't keep anyone from enlisting.
My opinion is everyone should be allowed to serve as long as we're still able to fight our wars.
Today, top Army and Air Force chiefs will testify.
In New York, terrorism suspect Najibullah Zazi pled guilty in a federal court yesterday. Attorney General Eric Holder says Zazi plotted with al-Qaeda to carry out an attack on American soil.
Zazi has admitted that he brought explosives to New York City on September 10th, 2009, and that he and others intended to detonate them on board the New York City subway system.
Zazi faces life in prison without parole. Overseas, our partner The New York Times reports that Pakistani authorities have captured another top Taliban leader, Mullah Kabir. He's reported to have overseen military operations in eastern Afghanistan. And finally, at home, visiting a U.S. hospital could be deadly, but not for the obvious reasons. A report out today says infections caught in U.S. hospitals killed nearly 50,000 patients and cost over $8 billion in 1 year alone. The latest figures are for 2006. And that's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now we got some takeouts on the stories we want you to keep on top of today. A judge has approved a $150 million settlement between Bank of America and the SEC, which gets Bank of America out from under the weight of a persistent legal problem. New York Times finance reporter Louise Story has been following this story for us. Louise, $150 million, I have to say, in the world of Bank of America doesn't sound like too much money, but this goes all the way back to when Bank of America merged with Merrill Lynch, right?
That's right. Todd, if this sounds like deja vu to you, this is deja vu because Last August, the SEC and Bank of America settled. They went before the same judge, but at that time, the settlement was only $33 million, and the judge threw the settlement out. It was really a groundbreaking event in the banking and SEC regulatory world. He threw it out. So what you're seeing, what happened yesterday, is that the SEC and Bank of America came back with a new settlement, and it is higher. $150 million is higher than $33 million. The judge said this is still paltry. He had very harsh words. He said this is half baked justice at best. However, he said that he has to show some deference, and so he did approve it even while he criticized the SEC and the bank.
That's some incendiary rhetoric, I guess, from the judge in the case, who sounds like a pretty colorful character, and yet it does sound on the face of it, and I'm not on the inside of the case, obviously, that $150 million in B of A land is sort of nickels and dimes.
It is, but what we're talking about here is just the first of several cases Bank of America has to deal with regarding the Merrill merger. This case is over the fact that Bank of America did not disclose huge losses that Merrill Lynch had right before the merger, and they didn't disclose huge bonuses that Merrill was, you know, paying, pushing out the door, money they were pushing out the door before the merger. And the judge was very clear. The bank has continued to say that these non-disclosures were not a problem, but the judge was very clear that if shareholders had known this information, he said, they would have thought twice about approving the merger, or they might have sought its renegotiation. So the judge very clearly established that shareholders were wronged, and this will have implications in many shareholder lawsuits against the bank, as well as a case that's still pending by the Attorney General of New York.
So the cost may come later on. It seems like up to this point, paying $150 million for not disclosing big bonuses or big losses might have been worth the money for Bank of America. I don't
know. Right, well, but the cost may be coming.
They may be coming later. Louise Story from the New York Times. Thanks.
And now for a takeout from Vancouver, Jason Stallman is with us again. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times. Women figure skaters are going to be on the ice tonight for their short programs. Lots of things going on. The U.S. men took gold in figure skating. So, Jason, anyone among the U.S. women expected to have a shot at a medal?
Frankly, the Americans don't really have a strong contender in this field. We'll have 30 skaters going in the short program, 2 minutes, 50 seconds each, and the best the Americans have to offer is probably Rachel Flatt. She's solid, but she's really not on par with some of the skaters from Japan and South Korea. This one's expected to go down to Kim Yuna, a South Korean skater who's trying to win the first figure skating gold for that country, and her main rivals are Mao Asada, Miki Ando of Japan.
Well, Rachel Flatt is quite young. Isn't she only like 17 years old?
She is. She's a straight-A student at Cheyenne High School in Colorado Springs, as a matter of fact.
Proud parents.
Absolutely.
So I assume that we're expecting that our young skaters, because 16-year-old Mira Nagasu. Yes, we're expecting them to grow into this sport, maybe come back in 4 years and be a little bit more strong contenders.
So that's certainly the hope, and Nagasu does have a lot of potential. She's certainly the United States' most colorful personality, but right now there's a pretty big gulf between Nagasu, Rachel Flatt, and the skaters from Japan and Kim Yuna of Korea.
Well, it'll still be well-watched and enjoyed show program, the Olympics event tonight. Jason Stallman, thanks so much. He's the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times.
For our last takeout now, we turn the microphone over to you, the listeners. Our series Frustration Nation continues later on this morning. And what's got you really frustrated? As one listener put it to us, congressional constipation.
I'm tremendously frustrated with the gridlock in Congress.
That's Jay calling us from Detroit on 8778-MY-TAKE.
I am even more frustrated with the fact that the media has, with the exception of Rachel Maddow, has done virtually nothing to explain filibuster and why there's gridlock to the American public.
I like to think we've tried to do our part, but we'll be talking more about your frustration with the media and the media later on this morning. But when we heard from many of you, most of you were most irritated by the stalling on one topic, that's healthcare.
This is Joel Ryan from Littleton, Colorado, and I think healthcare reform is stumbling because everyone's focused on insurance companies and costs and Byzantine systems like Medicare. So people need to be looking at what's going on with healthcare reform and our families.
Some of you are pretty nice. You had some polite advice for the folks on Capitol Hill.
My name is Juan. I'm calling from Miami. To fix the system is quite simple. limit corporate contributions to campaigns.
This is Miranda from South Carolina. I'm pretty frustrated with what's going on in Washington. I think since they can't accomplish anything to save us all some money, they should vote themselves a 20% pay cut and take a couple of furlough days to help bring down that budget deficit.
Well, that's likely if they can't pass health care, but the congressman will surely vote for a pay cut, right?
You know they always do. They always vote to lower their own salaries, don't they?
Yeah, not. What's your take? Are you frustrated with what's going on in Washington? And because frustration with Washington isn't a new thing, today we're asking you specifically, what's been the single most irritating moment that you've seen in politics, either now or maybe it's something that's happened in previous years? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post your comments on the website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the Pentagon says 21 Afghan civilians are dead after a failed NATO airstrike on Sunday. For the details of what went wrong and the consequences of such a mistake, we'll talk in a few minutes.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry for the next couple of days. Coming up, the Pentagon reports 21 Afghan civilians are dead after a failed NATO airstrike on Sunday. For the details on what went wrong and the consequences of such a mistake, we will talk in just a few moments with some people on the ground in Afghanistan. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. A glimpse of bipartisanship on Capitol Hill last night as five Republican senators broke ranks with their party and voted to advance a Democratic jobs bill. The bill allows businesses who hire unemployed workers to get some tax breaks. A full Senate vote is expected tomorrow. Meanwhile, President Obama hopes to keep the spirit alive as he renews his push for health care reform. Yesterday, he released an 11-page proposal that builds on legislation passed by the Senate, also has some House elements as well. Dr. David Stevens, the CEO of the Christian Medical Association, says this may be the president's last shot at health reform.
What seems so dead has been resurrected and is back on the table. The question is whether it's still dead and people just are pretending it's alive.
Republicans say the president's new proposals are nothing new.
In California, Anthem Blue Cross, the state's largest for-profit health insurer, is facing more than 700 violations for late payment of claims and giving misleading information to customers. California Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner says he wants to see some changes.
Pay all claims on time. Number two, pay all claims completely. Number three, when we're having settlement discussions, don't lowball.
President Obama recently criticized Anthem Blue Cross for proposing rate hikes as high as 39%. Meanwhile, the White House has approved a $1.4 billion loan for a solar energy project in California's Mojave Desert. The plant would power more than 140,000 homes. It's the largest federal loan guarantee for solar energy. And if your mother threw your comic books out when you were a kid, be sure you tell her this. A rare copy of the first comic book that featured Superman has now sold for $1 million. The comic dates back to 1938 with an original cover price of 10 cents. Actually, we had some very historic comic books that my grandfather had collected, and in order to protect them, my mom laminated them, therefore making them useless.
Therefore making Let's you a radio host instead of a
markets.
Rich woman.
Futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,383. The S&P opens at 1,108. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,242. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
A NATO airstrike on Sunday killed 21 Afghan civilians in a region northeast of Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expresses regret over the incident.
I do offer my heartfelt condolences not only to the loved ones of those killed in this incident, but to the Afghan people themselves, and to the family and friends of all those killed or wounded thus far in this operation, Afghan and coalition alike.
Now, this was the third such incident by NATO in Afghanistan. For more on what exactly happened, we're joined from Kabul by Rod Nordland, foreign correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. To start off, Rod, from the military perspective, the targeting of this convoy that resulted in this mistake, it clearly was a mistake. So what happened?
Well, what appears to have happened is that some American Special Forces helicopters were hunting for Taliban who had escaped from Marja, which is quite a long ways away from where this happened, about 150 miles away. And they saw several truck loads of people and for some reason assumed that they were insurgents and opened fire on them. And apparently all of them were civilians, including women and children. Now, NATO says that there was a patrol in the area, and a patrol of its forces on the ground, and that they were under some impression that these vehicles were on their way, were Taliban on their way to attack them. But how you square that account and the account of the helicopter is a little difficult to work out at this point, and they're not saying very much.
They're not saying much about that, and it's difficult to know because this is a pretty clear departure, it seems, from the stated policy of NATO under the command of General Stanley McChrystal. Last June, as you write, there was a shift in policy restricting the use of airstrikes, and this seems to have violated that restriction.
Yeah, and if you read the statement that they put out, I mean, McChrystal's quoted as saying that he has told his forces that incidents like this should not happen, and it sounds like he's quite upset about it. He immediately went over to the president's palace Sunday night to apologize in person and to explain to Karzai exactly why, what went wrong. He's not explaining that to us, so we don't really know the details, but we do know from the Afghan military that it was apparently American Special Forces helicopters.
Does Stanley McChrystal believe, do you think, that this is the worst possible news at the worst possible time? After all, the overall strategy as American and NATO forces push into Marja is to minimize civilian casualties and let the locals know that we're on their side.
Yes, and it's been not only a cornerstone of his policy, but it's been something that's been extremely important to Afghans. They were fed up during the Bush administration with repeated airstrikes that killed, you know, in some cases, hundreds of civilians. And during that period, the American military and NATO just basically stonewalled, lied, covered it up, didn't talk about it. And Afghans got increasingly furious about it, and it's something that really strikes a chord with them. Now, since McChrystal's policy, there really has only been one major incident, which was in Kunduz. And Kunduz, back in September, was a little bit of a gray area because it was a military target, although a lot of civilians were killed because they were at the target. At least it was a military target. This is the first case of a straight-out airstrike that killed a bunch of civilians where there was apparently no question that they were involved in any kind of insurgency.
Thank you, Rod Nordland, for foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, in Kabul.
And clearly, for a strategy that involves a small number of civilian deaths, this is a setback. We're joined now by Dr. Nadir Atash. He's a former Afghan government official. He was there from 2002 to 2006 and author of Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Nadir, we've heard already that Afghans are not happy about the deaths of women and children in this airstrike. And we are always here as well that these kind of civilian deaths send people into the ranks of the Taliban. Do you think that's the case in here, in this situation?
Unfortunately, I think that would be the case because the recent incident is not just something new. As your other guest indicated, this is one among a series of mishaps that have occurred from 2001 onwards. And we are fast losing the trust of Afghans. Think of it in this way, that the Afghans wholeheartedly supported the intervention of the U.S. NATO. And a lot of promises were made to improve their lives, but very little has been delivered. And on top of it, they get a corrupt government, lack of rule of law, injustices and atrocities committed on them by the government and that we have supported. And all they receive is death and nothing to improve their lives. I think we need to seriously deliver on some of those promises and quickly, and to regain the trust of people and take measures, appropriate measures in that regard.
We've been told by people on the ground in Afghanistan that Afghans, to a certain extent, expected civilians to be injured or killed in any kind of war that was going on in their country. So help me understand how each civilian death sends people going to the Taliban. How what kind of culture is there in Afghanistan that makes that reaction happen?
The Afghan code of conduct strongly emphasizes kinship and family, and those values are with us from throughout more than thousands of years. And what happens when something happens to a family, which the family does not deserve that kind of a incident, then they would do anything in their power to revenge that And not only that, but it's not only this family, but the entire population in Afghanistan that would sympathize with insurgents given these kind of mishaps and incidents.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Nadira Tosh, former Afghan government official. We're going to talk about work life coming up on Tuesday and weird questions. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Distressing news for the French wine industry. French exports of expensive champagne and cognacs suffered a record 17% drop last year. People were drinking less, and they switched to cheaper brands from the U.S. and Britain. Those are the largest foreign markets. So what does this mean? Is it an end to French domination in the wine industry? We're joined now by Bénédicte Pavillot. She's the U.K. correspondent for the international channel France 24. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Bonjour.
Bonjour. Bon matin. I don't know what time it is there. But why are Americans turning away from French wine? Is it just the price?
Well, that would probably be the case, because that's true also here in Britain. Unfortunately, many people choose the alcohol they're consuming, whether that's in a bar, a cafe, or in a shop, according to the price. Now, as a truly French girl, well-educated and raised, I hope it's a blessing, with quality, not quantity, I think that that's very sad, because I think that price is not everything, and it's better, well, I would say like clothes or jewelry, to have something of value and that is, of good quality, rather than having lots of it. And it's rotgut, as they call it over here, and vinegar. So I find that rather sad. Unless we think that everybody's becoming incredibly healthy and now consuming less alcohol. I'm not sure I believe that.
I don't believe that either. And I'm going to totally ignore the fact that you just called American wine vinegar. But is it...
Hold on. Let me correct that. I would not at all. I wouldn't want a diplomatic incident. Far be it from me. And if that was misconstrued, I apologize profusely. I've had fantastic wines from the Napa Valley at Zinfandel that I've never found again. But no, I would never accuse that. I was talking generally, it's true of French, Spanish, Italian, any wines. I was talking about quality, not nationality.
Right. So what is it that makes French wines in general more expensive? Oftentimes people feel like it's just because they have a French name.
Well, that's probably, I would say that that's a cliched view. I think that where the French market does have a problem is that the Anglo-Saxon market has really has these grapes. It looks at Syrah or other types of grapes, and that is something that the French wine market has been very slow to pick up on, is that Anglo-Saxons want to know what kind of grape is going to the wine. The French way of doing things is the château, it's the terroir, where it's come from, the tradition.
Region.
The region, exactly. Terroir coming from the word earth, and the quality, if you want, that not only of the local climate, the microclimate, and the tradition and the culture. So I think that that's one of the reasons. I think, of course, then when you export, it, obviously you have the taxes of the country. It's, French wine is much more expensive in Britain, for example, as well, than if you were to hop over the channel and go and, you know, load up, which a lot of British people do. What I can reassure you about is that the biggest consumer actually in the world of champagne outside France is Britain, and that doesn't look like it's going down anytime soon. But I think that, on the other hand, I think New Zealand particularly and Australia, New World Wines, to a lesser extent in the UK, American wines, have promoted themselves extremely well. And so if you get the right, you know, a low price,
and
then I think that people are very excited by that.
And I have to say, Bénédicte, oftentimes it's easier to pronounce our wines than it is to pronounce French wines. Bénédicte Pavillot is a UK correspondent for the international channel France 24, and she's talking about the huge reduction in sales on French exports of champagne and cognac. I'm Celeste Headlee, here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry for a couple more days. My very first job that I got at 16, the questions on the application were things like, what hours could you work, and can we call your references? Now the questions might sound something more like, what kind of tree would you be if you could be any tree? We're going to tell you how to answer that question the right way in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. A jobs bill is expected to pass in the Senate tomorrow after five Republicans, including the newest senator, Scott Brown of Massachusetts, joined Democrats to shut down a filibuster. The bill allows businesses that hire new workers to get tax benefits. Moving on to Afghanistan, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, says the fighting is not easy, but U.S. troops are making steady progress against the Taliban in the south.
I think we're headed in the right direction. We got the right leadership, the right strategy, the right resources, and I think we can succeed.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon has approved $150 million in military assistance for Yemen. That's more than double what the U.S. gave the country last year. And the Italian car company Fiat has announced it's shutting down all of its manufacturing plants in Italy for the next 2 weeks. That's because of a collapse in orders for new cars. Joining me now is BBC business correspondent Russell Padmore from London. Good morning, Russell.
So that's good morning to you.
Why is Fiat having to take this pretty extraordinary step of shutting down all of its plants?
The company's recognising the fact that sales have plummeted in January, Celeste. The Italian government was running a cash for clunkers programme, or a scrappage scheme, as we call it here in Europe. Orders, though, really plummeted when the government scheme came to an end. Rather much to the annoyance of the chief executive of Fiat, that's Sergio Marchionne, he kind of wanted it to continue. The company was making good sales on the back of it. When it came to an end, it's almost like he's sending a signal to the Italian government, we're closing down the plants, we're forced to. We have to cut costs. Interestingly, the company's foreign plants, like a key one in Poland that makes the new 500 model, that stays open.
Is this a bad sign for the Chrysler? Because Chrysler and Fiat are in a partnership right now.
No, it's not a bad sign for Chrysler at all, actually. Fiat is really, really focused on developing Chrysler. Sergio Marchionne's talked about a five-year business plan. This company will be selling 2.8 million vehicles from the brands like Chrysler, Jeep and Dodge by 2014. He forecast that last December. I'll give an example of it. Key control of the Jeep brand led to the company signing up a deal to build 500,000 vehicles every year in Russia. And just pretty recently, they have bought a factory in Sterling Heights in Michigan, the idea being that Detroit is going to be a key hub for Chrysler. They're going to build the Sebring and the Dodge Avenger. Jobs stay there. I'll give you an example of the cooperation between the companies. Pietro Golia, he's Fiat's point man at Chrysler in Detroit. He's described the relationship between both companies as a pipeline without a clog.
Okay, that is the BBC business correspondent Russell Padmore joining us from London.
Finally, let's check in on the Winter Games in Vancouver. The United States took silver in the ice dancing event. Charlie White, who won the medal with his partner Merrill Davis, says he's actually happy that his training partners, the Canadians, took gold.
We know what they're capable of, and you know, it's such an honor to be training with them. We really push each other every day, and I think we knew that it was going to come down to the two of us here at the Olympics.
If you're following the medal count, that ice dance silver medal brings the U.S. medal count to 25, followed by Germany with 21. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it's time to talk about work, and the new statistic says that there's now 6 unemployed Americans for every available job. That doesn't sound like a lot, but actually when you average that out, that's a lot of people applying for every open position, hundreds of applications for single spots. And there's some strange questions appearing on some of these applications. Many people are noticing them because they're filling out more applications, probably, than they normally would. Joining us to explain is our work contributor, Beth Kobliner, and also with us is Connie Thanasoulis-Seracchio. She's Vault.com's career expert and the former staffing head for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. So, Beth, first off, I want to play this comment from Human Resources Director of Zappos. That's the online shoe retailer. This is Rebecca Ratner.
Zappos asks employees a number of different questions that may be considered a little weird or strange. How weird you are, how lucky you are, or even what kind of theme music might play in a room when you walked in.
What theme music might play in a room when you walked in, Beth?
I think yours is wild thing, Celeste. I've been pondering this for a while.
I pick for my own theme music, Destiny's Child, I'm a Survivor.
There you go.
But this is a good question for our listeners. I want to throw this question out to all of our listeners out there. If you had theme music that played when you walk into a room, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us what your theme music would be. But Beth, back to Zappos.com. How is that? Why are people asking that question on job applications?
Well, I guess one reason is that it is certainly intriguing to hear what people are going to say, but more and more companies are doing this, and it's not sort of the randy, quirky interviewer. It's companies, corporations, actually putting in place these companies as a way to suss out this huge volume of people who want to be employees. It started in the 90s with Microsoft. They asked those sort of brain teaser questions like, why is a manhole cover round? How would you build an alarm clock for deaf people? How would you explain to use Microsoft to your grandmother? Those kind of questions. And now Target asks questions like, how much do you daydream? One person wrote in from a website called Glassdoor.com, where people write in all these kind of questions that they've asked. And she said, Best Buy asked if both a both a taxi and a limo were priced at the exact same, which one would you choose? So there are all these kind of interesting questions. If you were an item in a supermarket, what would you be? They're trying to figure out how the respondent, how the applicant would either handle the pressure or sort of respond in a way that might suit the culture of the company.
Okay, so Connie Thanasoulis of Saracchio, you are with Vault.com, you're their career expert, but you also were the forming staffing head for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. What are companies trying to find out with these questions?
Well, you know, there are a lot of very good qualified candidates out there, and we really have to cut through the quick to make sure we have the right person, the person who fits the corporation the best. And a lot of times, if the corporation is fast, dynamic, entrepreneurial, we might ask, you know, what kind of a car would you be? Well, a Lamborghini would be a great answer. You might want to talk about how bright the red is on a Lamborghini, and, you know, because we don't want to hire a minivan type of person. So it really has to do with the culture of the organization, and it also has to do with the creative nature of the candidate. We want someone who's not only really good at the basic skills of a job, we want someone who is extraordinary in their thought processes, in how they think about themselves. We want someone who's confident enough to talk about what kind of a tree would they be. You know, I'd be an oak tree. I want to be as tall and strong. I want to reach towards the sky higher than any other tree. You know, I want to outperform anyone else at this company.
You know, Beth, but yeah, I have to ask you, how do you answer these questions right?
Right.
I mean, can you be completely honest? Because I don't think you can.
No, I mean, you can't. And also, I sort of question what kind of methodological study has been done that shows that somebody says a Lamborghini is better than a minivan. You know, like what really will prove that? But I do think that if a question is completely bizarre, the advice is you have to just go with it. No matter what the interviewer is asking you, they're asking you for a reason. So try to answer with a straight face. They want to see if you're going to get frazzled, so don't get angry. They want to see if you could think on your feet, keep cool, just do your best. You know, 40% of interviewers spend less than 30 minutes asking people questions for a job, so you're not going to have a lot of time to prove yourself. So if you're thrown one of these questions, you want to make sure to make a good impression and just keep it cool, take it seriously. And you should know that if there's no right or wrong. And generally speaking, you know, one person said, if it's a high pressured company, say you're a tiger. If it's a low pressured company, say you're a squirrel. I don't know, you know, but no matter what it is, you want to come up with something that sounds fairly reasonable and keep the interview moving.
Okay, so Connie, let me ask this question to you. You heard what Beth just said. I would never pick a Lamborghini because I have all kinds of negative associations with middle-aged men that drive sports cars. Not in, you know, just because we've had all this news about, you know, midlife crises. That's what I associate a Lamborghini with. So how can you tell from these answers?
Well, you know, you have to, you must practice. You have to practice interview questions that are traditional and non-traditional so that you're comfortable with what comes out and it makes sense. So when you practice the traditional questions, you're going to feel more confident should an untraditional question come your way. So you have to be, there is no right or wrong answer, as Beth said, but you have to show enthusiasm. You have to show that you're having fun with yourself. There is no right or wrong answer, okay. But you're going to do the best you can do, because that's what an interview is all about. When someone interviews, they're in the lead, you have to follow.
All right, so that's Connie Thanasoulis Saracchio. She's a career expert with Vault.com, also our Takeaway Work contributor, Beth Koebleiner. This is my theme song. I'm
there
a survivor. We're asking our listeners to let us know what their theme music is. If you're going to walk in a room, what music would be playing? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Celeste, I always thought yours would have been Panic in Detroit. You know, I always fall back on David
Bowie
in these
situations. Oh, no, I'm not panicked
situations.
In Detroit. I'm happy in Detroit. Oh. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.